Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
The Holy Book of Islam, the Quran. The claims made by Muslim believers about this book are rather remarkable, and remarkable claims require remarkable evidence. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about the historical and textual problems with the Quran. Joining us to do so on this Friday afternoon, Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, author of several books, including his latest, The Critical Quran, explained from key Islamic commentaries and contemporary historical research. Robert, welcome back.
Good to talk to you as always, Todd. Thank you.
How does the Quran compare to the Bible theologically?
There are vast differences. In the first place, I suppose I should start with a similarity, and that is that both preach monotheism, but that's about the extent of the similarity. The Quran teaches that Allah, the supreme God, is absolute will, and thus there is no immutable moral code to which he is bound. That is considered to be a limitation on his all-encompassing authority. And Allah in the Quran says, I could have guided everyone to the truth, but instead I will fill hell with men, which is an idea that's abhorrent to the Bible that says God desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. You have, of course, the denial of the Trinity, the denial of the resurrection, the denial of the sonship of God. These things are all central to Islam. So while Islam has the biblical prophets and Jesus, they're cast in a very different way to fit within the Islamic framework in which human beings are essentially not the children of God, but his slaves, meant to follow his orders absolutely without any questioning and without any kind of personal relationship or filial relationship with him.
What do Muslims themselves, what are they taught and what are they taught to believe about the book, the Quran?
The Quran is the perfect and immutable word of Allah that existed forever with Allah in paradise and was delivered in perfect form over a period of 23 years to Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. This is standard Islamic teaching to the extent that you will find Islamic apologists, even in our own day, claiming that Allah has miraculously preserved every manuscript of the Quran so that every last one is identical in every respect to every other one, and you will not find any divergence, and that this is a sign that this is the book from Allah. So one of the things that I did in the critical Quran that is unusual for Qurans in English is to have variant readings listed, which many Islamic apologists would not even admit exist. And they cut against the theological idea that the Quran is this perfect and eternal book, and every last copy of it is also miraculously protected.
So go into a little more detail of how the Quran as a text is related to Muhammad the man.
Muhammad is just the conduit for the Quran. The Quran is a perfect copy, as I said, of the mother of the book, it's called, the al-Kitab in paradise, which exists forever with Allah. And then he delivers it through the angel Gabriel to Muhammad. So on the one hand, Muhammad is just a human being who receives this. And theoretically, the choice of Muhammad is based on solely Allah's will. And consequently, Muhammad is just a human being. And Muslims take great pains to emphasize that they do not consider him divine and do not worship him. But at the same time, the Quran in chapter 33, verse 21 says that Muhammad is an excellent example, which seems like a simple enough phrase, but its meaning is given extraordinary weight in Islamic theology. The idea is that he's an excellent example in every last thing. in everything you can imagine doing, you should imitate Muhammad. And so the Hadith literature, which is volume after volume, dozens of volumes of material about Muhammad's words and deeds, all that material was elaborated in order to satisfy the hunger within the Islamic community for news about what Muhammad said and did, so that Muslims would actually know how to behave and obey the Quranic command that he is to be obeyed himself as well as Allah, and that he's an excellent example in all things. Now, this has the tendency to lead to a certain kind of de facto deification of Muhammad that I think is exemplified most vividly in the fact that he cannot be pictured. Any human being can be pictured. And before there were photographs, there was, of course, portrait artwork, and there were depictions of human beings from time immemorial. But it's forbidden in Islamic law to depict Muhammad, because the contention is that to do so would lead to idolatry if his magnificence were fully captured in any kind of depiction. And so you even have movies that have been made recently that have Muhammad in them, but he's never shown. Sometimes you might hear a voice, but even that sometimes is not done. And so while Muhammad is not worshipped technically in Islam, nonetheless, he has such an exalted status that he practically takes the place of a divinity anyway.
So in biblical scholarship, as a Christian, I can say God is the author of Holy Scripture, but we also speak about human authors. Is Muhammad considered in any sense an author of the Quran?
No, he's only a passive conduit. The Quran, as compared to the Bible, is kind of like this. You sometimes find Bibles with the words of Christ in red. The Quran, if you were to do that, it would all be in red. That is, every word of it is supposed to be spoken by Allah. Now, this creates problems in itself also in various passages in which Allah is apparently referring to himself in the third person. And it's clear, actually, from the plain meaning of those passages that somebody else is speaking, and this was not originally envisioned as being the speech of Allah, but that is standard Islamic theology, that Allah is the only speaker in the entire Quran. So there's no concept of anything such as the gospel according to Matthew, according to Mark, and so on. There's no according to in the Quran. It's all absolutely the pure and perfect word of Allah, according to Islamic theology anyway.
How is the Quran structured?
The Quran is structured in a very strange way. There is no linear, chronological, historical, or thematic structure to it. It's solely based, and even this is not a perfect organization or a consistently followed one, but it's roughly organized according to the idea of the longest chapter to the shortest. The first, of course, this is with the exception of the Fatiha, the opening, the first chapter of the Quran, which is only seven verses. And it's kind of like the Lord's Prayer in Islam. And then you have the longest chapter, the Kaw, chapter 2, which is 286 verses. And then it goes down to chapter 114, which again is only two or three verses. And there is a general tendency for the longer to go to the shorter, although, as I say, it's not entirely consistent. And this creates a kind of a backwards book, because it's generally agreed that the shorter chapters at the back of the Quran were ones that were revealed earliest in Muhammad's career as a prophet, and the longer ones come later. But even that is problematic given the questions about the historicity of Muhammad in general.
So it's not a narrative or even a series of narratives. What is it then?
It's kind of a series of sermons, you could say. And there is sometimes a sharp and unannounced switch from one topic to another, sometimes with unity with what came before and sometimes not. Sometimes, of course, that unity is imposed from without, and even some words, there is no certainty as to what they actually mean, and the understanding of what they mean is imposed by Islamic theologians coming to the text afterward. There are narratives in it, but it's generally a series of exhortations to the believers and to unbelievers as well, to believe in Allah and to obey Allah and Muhammad and to understand that there is only this one God. That's basically it. All the stories of the prophets, even that are appropriated from the Bible, are recast in a way such that they all have the same message. And that is that the prophet came, he preached Allah, the unity of Allah, the unbelievers clung to their idols and scoffed at the prophet, and they were judged. And every last story of the prophet pretty much follows this pattern. And that, of course, is the overall pattern of the Quran regarding the message that it is bringing as a whole, that Muhammad is the new prophet, and people may scoff, but they will face the judgment in the end and on this earth as well.
Why do we need to be aware of the commentaries that have been written on the Quran?
The Quran is not an easy book to read, particularly for non-Muslims who do not speak Arabic. The Quran is properly in Arabic. Muslims maintain that it's not even really the Quran if it's not in Arabic. It's just a translation of the meanings. The Quran itself, it is considered that the music and the rhythm of the Arabic language is intrinsic to it, and thus you have to have it in Arabic. But in any case, if an English-speaking reader wants to pick up an English translation of the Quran, even one that is made by Muslims and for Muslims who don't speak Arabic, he or she will be confronted with the fact that the Quran does not have any thematic unity or chronological unity, and it skips from topic to topic without any apparent organization. And it often refers to events without filling in the details of those events, as if you were talking to someone and I don't know either of you, and I walk up and you don't fill me in on what you're talking about, I won't have any idea what the topic of your discussion is. And that's a lot like reading the Quran. So you have to go to the Islamic commentaries on the Quran, in many cases, even understand what the Quranic text is saying. And so in the critical Quran, I provide those commentaries so that people can indeed follow along with the Quran and get some idea of what exactly is going on.
What other factors make studying and understanding the Quran so difficult?
Another factor that is a problem with other translations of the Quran, and one of the reasons why I produced this one, is because many of the existing English translations of the Quran actually are designed to obfuscate rather than clarify what the Quranic text actually says. This is because many of the things in the Quran, such as the permission to beat one's wife if you fear disobedience from her, those things are abhorrent to many Westerners and embarrassing to Muslims. And so many English translations of the Quran try to obscure or soften those passages. And the Quran that I have produced here just gives you what it actually says and breaks through that obfuscation. Other difficulties that are created by the text are the fact that it's so decontextualized. Many times Muslims will object when non-Muslims quote the Quran, "Oh, you're taking it out of context," which is always a funny thing. It always amuses me when I hear them say it, because the Quran is a very decontextualized book. It does not fill in the context of what's going on in very many cases at all. These things just are being said to people who seem to know the speaker of them, and the details are not given. The background is not given. And so that makes it very hard to understand for somebody who doesn't know that background.
Are we aware of early or perhaps even contemporary variant editions of the Quran?
There are a few editions of the Quran that exist. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, the very courageous Christian convert from Islam and Christian apologist in Britain, Hatun Tash, went to Morocco and was shopping for variant editions of the Quran, came back with about 45, if I recall correctly, different editions of the Quran. Now, all of these variant books, there's not a whole lot of divergence. in the Quranic text. Nonetheless, there are multiple traditions of the Quranic text and hundreds of variants, many of which I have listed in the Critical Quran. All of them minor, but all of them give the lie to the repeated claim that the Quranic text is always consistent, has always been the same, and is the same in every Quranic manuscript.
So how do Islamic scholars explain the variants of the Quran?
The general idea is to attribute them to the variant reading traditions. There are traditions that go back to the early days of Islam about Muhammad being revealed the Quran in seven dialects of Arabic, and then those becoming the bases for various manuscript traditions of the Quran. And so many times now, being confronted with these variant readings, Islamic apologists will scoff at the idea that they were just repeating a few years ago that the Quran has never changed and all the manuscripts are the same. And instead, they'll say every school child in the Islamic world knows that there are these various readings and that they differ slightly. But even then, you will find some of these apologists insisting that these are just variations of pronunciation of the Quranic text and that the Quranic text itself is consistent. But others will concede that there are variant readings actually, but that all of these are willed by Allah. And so they don't mitigate against the perfection of the text. But this is a very weak argument because it opens the door to the possibility of variance. And then one has to affirm that Allah spoke this perfect book in all these different ways. It's very strange because the variations can't really be accounted for on the basis of different dialects or something like that. They're just minor things like passages that say they said instead of he said, or we said instead of he said, things like that. There's really no accounting for that as being the unified message of a perfect book. Clearly, these are just counsels of despair designed to try to explain away an uncomfortable fact.
Robert Spencer is our guest. We're talking about historical and textual problems with the Quran on this Friday afternoon, July the 1st. He's director of Jihad Watch and author of several books, including his latest, The Critical Quran. When we come back, what are some other problems with the transmission of the Quran? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive word and sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide word and sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about historical and textual problems with the Quran. Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch is our guest. So picking up on something you said before the break, Robert, in Christian biblical scholarship, whether you look at the Hebrew text of the Old Testament or the Greek text of the New Testament, you will find critical editions of those texts where it's called critical apparatus, footnotes. Every variant is accounted for, very honestly accounted for, right there in the critical edition. I take it that Muslims don't really have any interest in doing that with the Quran.
Yeah, that's correct. Like I said before, there are additions here and there that list the variants or some of them, but this is something that's very rare and actually quite new in Qurans in English and in Islamic studies in general. This is something that Muslims have been slow to want to acknowledge and are still coming to grips with the implications of it.
Talk about some of the problems with the historical transmission of the Quran.
Well, the Quran is supposed to have been collected together in the year 653. All the people who had memorized portions of it were gathered together by the Caliph Uthman, the leader of the Islamic community, and what they had memorized was written down, and variants were burned, and the single unified Quran was distributed to the provinces. That's the story. However, there is no mention of the Quran or quotations from it in contemporary literature for another 40 years after that, which is very strange if that story is historical. Then you start to get quotations from the Quran, but there are numerous variations. For example, there are inscriptions on the wall of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, which was built in 691, that quote the Quran, but some of them diverge from the Quranic text. And so you have to wonder, are they actually quoting from the Quran, or were those passages taken and put into the Quran later on? Then in the early 700s, you have St. John of Damascus, one of the earliest Christian writers to engage with Islam theologically and to debate with Muslims. And he writes about the Quran's chapter 2, the cow that I mentioned earlier, as if it were a separate book. He says, I've read the Quran and I've read Surah Al-Baqarah, that is the chapter of the cow, which is not the way people ordinarily speak if the chapter of the cow was actually in the book at the time. And so that suggests that maybe it wasn't, and that the Quran was actually collected much later and made into a unified book much later than the Islamic tradition would have it. And that idea would be also be consistent with the fact that we don't start getting actual quotes from it until much later than we would expect, given the story about it all being collected together in 653 by Uthman. We don't have a full manuscript of the Quran until after 800 AD. And it's only after that that we start getting the proliferation of the Hadith literature about Muhammad and the codification of Islamic theology. And it seems much more likely that the Quran and Islam itself date more properly from that time than from the middle of the 7th century or the beginning decades of the 7th century, where the standard canonical story would place it.
Again, in biblical scholarship, there is a plethora of manuscript evidence, either partial or complete manuscript evidence, in some cases whole books or books altogether bound together, and it numbers in the tens of thousands. Is there something comparable to that in Quranic study?
Yeah, there are a lot of Quranic manuscripts out there, and a great many of them are publicly available. But what's strange is that there is a huge cache of very early Quran manuscripts that are in Yemen, the Sana'a manuscripts, that many of them have never been revealed, never been made public. And people have suggested that the Yemeni government is aware that they contain variants that differ sharply from the standard canonical text, which incidentally was codified in 1924. Most of the Qurans you get nowadays are the 1924 text. Not that it was written in 1924, but that in 1924, the Saudis got together and they... it was in Egypt at Al-Azhar, I believe. In any case, they put together a standard manuscript of the Quran that is the basis for most of the Qurans that are published by the Saudis today and by others. The problem is, though, that other manuscript traditions still exist. This is why Hatun Tash was able to find so many when she went to Morocco. This was just a few years ago. And so the existence of these variants has still never been adequately explained or adequately dealt with by Islamic scholars. And many of these manuscripts have never even been examined.
Is there evidence of early editing going on?
Yes, there is. As a matter of fact, the Islamic scholar Daniel Brubaker has published an entire book that contains portions of Quran manuscripts that show signs of editing and that clearly show that the manuscript was changed for whatever reason at some point. And this is quite obvious and true of a great many of these Quranic manuscripts, which also suggests that some effort was made to bring variant manuscripts into line with the dominant tradition.
Talk about the evidence for the existence of Muhammad himself as a prophet of Islam in the 7th century.
Well, here again, it's a very curious absence, because Muhammad is supposed to have lived from 570 to 632 and have exercised his prophetic career from 610 to 632. And yet, you go from the 630s to the 690s, and there are only a few scattered mentions of Muhammad, and absolutely none of them correspond in their details to what we are told about the career, the life and career of the Prophet of Islam today. In other words, they don't fit the standard Islamic story. Now, this is very strange. This is extraordinary, because when you consider the fact that the Arabs were conquering massive amounts of territory at this time, the omission becomes all the more curious. They conquered the Middle East, Iran, North Africa, parts of India. By 732, you have this massive empire stretching from Spain to India, all across North Africa and through the Middle East and Iran. And yet, from the 630s to the 690s, you have virtually no mention of Muhammad and no mention at all of the Prophet of Islam. In contemporary records in the 7th century, you have non-Muslims speaking about how they were conquered, speaking about the conquerors, never even calling them Muslims, never giving a hint that they were called Muslims, never even giving any idea that they seem to have had a new prophet, a new religion, and a new holy book. Now, this is absolutely extraordinary, since the standard canonical story is that these conquests were motivated by the teachings of the Quran and Muhammad. And so you would think that the unbelievers, when they're trying to find out what's going on and why these people are conquering, why they're invading, that they talk to the conquerors, that the conquerors would say, well, we have this new prophet and he told us to make war against unbelievers and so on. Not a word. And that is absolutely breathtaking and calls for an explanation.
So, to put a fine point on that, what problem does that lack of evidence for Muhammad as a prophet of Islam there in the 7th century and beyond, what problems does that present for the Quran itself?
Well, it actually presents not as much of a problem for the Quran as you might think, Todd, because the Quran only mentions Muhammad by name four times, and none of those mentions have any biographical information about him. The Quran is very concerned that you obey the messenger, and I made reference to that as obeying Muhammad earlier, because that's how it's understood in Islamic tradition. But actually, there's no necessary reason why, when the Quran refers to the messenger, there's no reason that is intrinsic to the text that means that it's Muhammad that is being referred to. It may be that the Quran is made up of material that was calling on people to obey some other messenger, and that material was adapted and put into the Quran. And this buttressing that view is the very strong indications that portions of the Quran were adapted from Christian texts. For example, there's a very curious passage at the end of chapter 5 of the Quran where Jesus's followers ask him to send down a miraculous table laden with food from heaven. And scholars have pointed out that this contains numerous linguistic resonances with the Eucharist. And that actually is the only thing that makes the passage clear. Otherwise, it's a very strange thing for the followers of Jesus to be asking him to produce And that suggests that some Eucharistic text was adapted in order to create this passage in the Quran. And there are many other passages of this kind that give strong hints that they're adapted from Christian literature. So it may be that other passages of the Quran that refer to the messenger were originally referring to another messenger altogether, maybe Jesus in some cases.
And how do Muslims square that with their beliefs about the Quran, that perhaps it was simply borrowing from Christian ideas or texts?
This is something that Islamic scholars have shown very scant inclination to deal with at all. And so when I wrote my book, Did Muhammad Exist? For the most part, the answers to it were on the quality of that of Anjum Chowdhury, the famous British imam whom I debated. You can find the debate on YouTube. And he said, of course Muhammad existed. It's in the Quran. So the circularity of that didn't seem to bother him or impress him at all. And for the most part, there has not been any large-scale confrontation of the evidence that strikes against the historicity of Muhammad and the Quran in the Islamic community. One notable exception was the imam Wolfgang Sven Kalisch, who was a convert to Islam in Germany and a very prominent one, who held a teaching position in a university teaching about Islam, and he examined the evidence for Muhammad and the Quran from a historical standpoint and ended up leaving Islam as a result.
So if a Muslim honestly examines the historical and textual evidence, what do you hope he would conclude about the Quran?
Well, I hope that he would see that this is not possibly a book that could have really come from God, and that it's not a miraculous book, that it contains doctrines that are frankly pernicious, like the one that I alluded to at the beginning of this program, Todd, about Allah deciding to send people to hell rather than to save them, even though he says right there that he could have saved them if he wanted to, and that this kind of thing is not worthy of the idea of a supreme being.
Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch. He's author of several books, including his latest, The Critical Quran, Explained from Key Islamic Commentaries and Contemporary Historical Research. You can purchase this book on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Robert, thank you.
Pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Up next, we'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the one-year lectionary, talking with Pastor David Peterson about the parables of the lost sheep, coin, and the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.